unknown and mysterious creatures. They are the stuff of nightmares. They terrify us as much as they pique our interest. We've heard the stories, the lore, the legends, but we thrust beyond the threshold of peril to find another clue, another morsel of reason to believe. New Kingdom Radio Theater presents Unknown and Mysterious Creatures, hosted by JV Torres. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Anchor, and other podcast platforms. Each episode can also be found at youtube.com/JVMYKA.
This podcast may involve topics that are triggering, like violence, sex, or mental illness. If any of that might disturb you or those around you, please reconsider listening. It's okay to take care of yourself. If you ever feel unsafe or suicidal, please contact your local crisis center, emergency services, or national hotline. In the U.S., the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 988 or 800-273-8255. You matter.
Hey, this is Kate. It's a rough time of year for a lot of people, assuming that you're listening to this around the time it comes out, which is December 3rd, 2022. People have a mindset that the holidays are when most people die by suicide, and that's not actually true for a couple of different reasons. The short version being that a lot of people believe that this is the time of year when everybody's unhappy and stressed out and whatever, fill in the blank. And so their mood feels normal, common to them, and they're okay with that. And so actually, it's on the Northern Hemisphere when spring rolls around. And so, I mean, same Southern Hemisphere, it's just a different time of year. Anyway, the point is, a lot of my listeners are from the Northern Hemisphere, and right now, a lot of them are struggling. A lot of them are unhappy. And to the point where lately, as stress fatigue and pandemic fatigue get to us, I've had people talk to me about, like, what do I do? How do I cope with this? And the answer isn't therapy for everybody, but the answer is kind of therapy for everybody, you know, like in some form or other. It doesn't need to be formalized psychotherapy. There are other ways that you can pursue a sense of levelness and happiness that don't have to be in an office or on Zoom or whatever. But, you know, it couldn't hurt. But if therapy bothers you, if the idea of therapy is not your thing, then listen to this episode. I'm talking to someone, her name is Monique Rhodes, and her job title is being a happiness strategist. And that just sounds fascinating to me, like just hearing that concept of making it a deliberate strategy that you're going to pursue, as opposed to just accepting, like, look, I'm going to feel awful right now, and that's how it's going to be. So, I mean, this may not be the answer for you also. That's fair. There's a lot of different forms of therapy. Books, self-help, therapists, Zoom, happiness strategists. There's a lot of forms out there because there's a lot of people out there and people respond differently. But give it a listen. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss.
My name's Monique Rose. I'm a happiness strategist. You can probably tell by my unique little accent that I come from the bottom of the world, a little country called New Zealand, where most people think that everybody's extremely happy because, of course, it's the most beautiful country in the world, probably. But for me, I had some serious problems with happiness when I was younger that led me on a journey to all over the world that I traveled to try and find the answer to what could make me happier. And it led me to transform my life. And now this is what I teach other people to do, how to be happier. I don't think there's a more fun job than that, Kate. Come on, let's be serious.
I don't know. I'm a forensic psychologist. I get to hang out with serial killers. So, you know, you probably win. This is why I thought, before I hit record, this is why I thought that you had written a book, is because you talked about strategist and happiness, and that often to me that goes, so I'm going to hit you right up front with, how come you haven't written a book?
It's a matter of time. I wish I could clone myself. I do so much work with people live and on my programs that I haven't had a chance, but we're in the process at the moment of doing it.
Well, then I'm putting you on the spot right now to say I really feel like the only correct thing is to come back on the show once you do.
I would love to.
Ideal. So, okay, what is the secret then? Where is your happiness? Where did you find it?
It's a good question. I think the secret that I discovered was that most of us chase happiness. You know, we think that if I get a raise, whatever, there's an endless list of what I call as soon as happinesses. Things that as soon as I have them, I'm going to be happy. And I think that our society is set up to lead us to believe that. I mean, that's what consumerism is all about. Buy these things and you'll be happy. And so it's very difficult for us to not fall into that myth of believing that if my external circumstances change, I'll be happier. And what I learned was that it wasn't that at all. And I think the first time I really started to get a glimpse of it was I was in my early 20s and I went to Thailand. And I remember going through this canal in Thailand on this little boat, and there was a man on the riverbank, and he was literally living under four bamboo poles and a tarpaulin. And he had a few belongings beside him, and he was sitting there cross-legged. And I remember just seeing a joy on his face that maybe I hadn't seen. Like, it was a free joy, like a really vital look of joyfulness. And how could a man with so little have the joy that I could see that everyone was looking for? And it made me start to understand, or start to get an indication that perhaps all the things that we chase, particularly in the West, were not the answer to happiness. And maybe happiness was coming from somewhere else. And so the secret that I discovered that was really, really life-changing for me was that happiness was found in my mind. It wasn't actually found outside of myself at all. And that depending on how my mind was, changed my experience of my external circumstances.
See, I have I don't want to say interesting because that's judgy and maybe it's boring to people, but I have a relationship with happiness in the sense that I get a little nervous if I feel active euphoric happiness, because I wait for it to burn off. I'm a little bit of a nihilist, and I wait for the comet to make its Doppler sound and come out of the sky and land on my head. And so my goal in life, I don't want to be happy. I want to be content. I want to learn how to be okay with where and who I am. And I've had people look at me and be like, oh, you're selling yourself short. That's not enough. And for the most part, I'm able to say thank you rather than bite me. But that I understand they want to feel, you know, roller coaster happy. And I just feel like there's something about that word that makes me feel like there's an inevitable crash.
I totally get you. Okay. And there is with that definition of happiness, because I would suspect, and this is semantics, but I would suspect that what you're talking about is a little more joy, those kind of peaks, you know, something amazing's happening. You get this peak, you feel really good. And that peak might last for 5 minutes a day, a week, right? But when we talk about happiness, what we're looking for is a lasting happiness. I'm looking for the same thing that you're talking about, and it is possible. But maybe the word is a lasting happiness rather than a kind of peak happiness. So peak happiness is like, I'm going to buy a new car and I see this car and I think, oh, yes, I can't wait to have that car. And I get in this car and I love it and I love driving it. And then over time, I'm just driving my car because the peak's gone. Or I meet this person and I'm dating them and they're awesome and I'm just so in love and nothing could get any better than this. And then one day they say something that is really not good. And all of a sudden I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I love you as much as I thought I did. And all of a sudden the shine's going off. So everything can have that shine, but what we're looking for is a stability in our happiness so that no matter what happens, we can experience it. And contentment is a beautiful word for it, but maybe I want to say you can have a bit more than that. Like you can have that solidity without being afraid that if you're feeling happy consistently, that the other shoe's going to drop. And so again, that's where we see most of these feelings that come, that are passing, that are more transient, are actually coming from more peak experiences or experiences that are, again, reliant on external circumstances rather than internal. And as we work with our mind, as we shift our mind and change our mind, the actual structure of the mind is able to change. Like the biological structure of the mind can change. This was tested. There's a Tibetan Buddhist monk who went to UCLA. He was the translator for the Dalai Lama. His name is Matthew Rickard. And he went to UCLA and they did tests on him. He's done heaps and heaps and heaps of working with his mind, meditation. And they did these tests at UCLA. And when they first put the equipment on his head, they thought that there was a fault in the equipment because the areas of his brain that lit up where all of his happiness was so much larger than they'd ever seen in a human being before. That's why Matthew Rickard is known as the happiest man in the world, because they hadn't seen it. So it's actually possible to change the structure of your brain so that happiness, that lasting happiness, is something that you can experience a lot more. And it's something that I think everybody deserves, and it doesn't need to be fleeting.
Do you think that people are, and there may not be an answer to this, I don't know, but it bear with me because I'm not going to necessarily word it well my first pass through, but in your experience, do people chase a fleeting happiness that's not possible, or are they more prone to self-limiting? Because they don't believe
interesting. They chase a fleeting happiness believing it's a solid one, right? That's where the problem lies. When I get this job, I'm going to be great. I'm in this job at the moment. I can't stand it. I'm miserable. I hate my boss. Here's this job. It's my dream job. When I get there, I'm going to be happy. And that's the mistake. I meet this person. When I fall in love, I'm going to be so happy. When I leave my marriage, I'm going to be so happy. And of course, the way that life works is that everything has a shadow side. So the problem comes when we put all our eggs into this basket of this job. And what we do is we give our happiness power away to something that is always going to let us down. And so when we start to shift and understand that the mind is the ordering principle, the mind is the decider of our happiness or suffering, we start to realize that we have the ability to be in control of our mind if we tame and train it. And as we create more stability in our mind, we're able to have more stability in our life. Because when our mind is in charge of our happiness or our suffering, then it's up to us. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's one of my favorite things in the world is synchronicity, when through no plan, things collide. So it's not my story to tell, but there's someone that I know that was deeply unhappy in a given situation, a given living situation. And they asked to come stay with me. This was back in early June. And my husband and I and our children discussed it, and we decided, okay, you know, we're of the mindset that if you can help, you should try. And so we said, okay. And today, about 6 hours ago, that person moved out because they were not happy here, their version of happy. And I remember saying to them last night, I said to them, you know, wherever you move, you're still going to be there. And that it's not about the four walls that surround you, that if you refuse to be okay, then you certainly can't be more than okay. You can't find, you know, your version of happy. You want vacation all the time is the phrase that I used. And that life is not vacation all the time. The reason vacation feels great is because it's vacation, but you still go back to your life. And what you're trying to do is move from place to place. And as recently as 24 hours ago, the plan was, okay, I'll see a therapist. Okay, I'll start in some different ways to retrain my mind in at least starting in one format to rechange. I don't know that that's the only path. I don't believe there's a single path to happier, but they were going to try one. I'm going to try this one way. And they woke up this morning and decided, no, moving is the only answer and I'll be happier. And I tell you what, they weren't gone 3 hours before they got in touch with me and asked to move back in. And my answer was no, that I have a family of six here. We need stability. We need to be okay. We need our family's version of happy to reform now because everything has been shaken up. And so we need some time to heal from the events of the past week or so and figure out what happy looks like next. And so I'm on the shit list is the answer, but that's okay. I can deal with that.
And I think that understanding of, you know, what you said of wherever you go, you're going to be there. There you are. That is where we get ourselves into trouble because we have habitual patterns of the mind that we're unconscious of. So for your friend, until they're able to look at how do I set myself up to repeatedly fall into this habit of creating misery wherever I live, it's not going to change. And at some point, the need to look at those habitual patterns will be vital, and they either will or they won't. They'll continue doing the same thing, or eventually they'll live by themselves and they'll might be okay that way. And I think that that's what we don't understand is that our minds are deeply habitual and we repeat the same patterns over and over again, which is why you can put someone, you know, you could put someone like your friend in the most glorious situation and they still would end up being unhappy. They wouldn't be able to help themselves.
Right. Living with
you. Of course. There's no question. That's glorious. Of course. You know, and so that's where it's vital for us to get some understanding of how we sabotage our own happiness, literally by not understanding where our mind goes to habitually.
Prior to, you said early 20s that you kind of started to come to this realization. Prior to that, what did happy look like for you?
Happiness was deeply elusive. I grew up in a messy situation in my home, adopted at 10 days old into an environment that was really unhealthy for me. So happiness was something that I believed would happen when I left home. And I left home at 17. And it was shocking to me to leave home and move out of the circumstances that were causing so many problems and still not be able to nail this happiness deal. You know, what was it? I was sure as soon as I left home. But of course, I'd set myself up by that point again into habitual habits of the mind and all of the negativity that I had been living in, I carried with me as my own voice in my own head. So it was really a deprogramming in a lot of ways that had to happen. So happiness for me when I was younger was just those fleeting moments, you know, fleeting things that happened, and consistently trying to stay as positive as I could. That's where my mind went to. But I'm pretty sure I was pretty depressed during my teenage years. Looking back, in hindsight, I would call it depression.
So happiness for you is a radical act.
Happiness for me is an act of desperation to survive, you know, because I was at a point at 19 where I wasn't surviving. I was in hospital having tried to take my own life. So I either had to figure it out or I didn't feel that I could continue. So you know, there's nothing like desperation to get you on track with what you need to learn. So for me, when I was younger, happiness was a matter of life or death.
What would have happened, again, with the poorly worded questions, but do you feel that you were, I don't like the word fate, but let's go with it. Do you feel that you were fated to find where you're at, happiness, eventually? And if it hadn't been the man under the bridge in Thailand, it would have been a woman behind a barn in Scotland or something like that? Or do you feel like it had to be that moment in that person and you, where you were at in that point in your life?
I think that there's a deep drive and determination in me. And that was what enabled me to go on a journey that took me a very, very long time to figure out how to shift myself. And so I think, could we say it was fate or karma or whatever? It's a guessing game. Who knows? These were the circumstances I grew up in. They were very particular and very specific. And that coupled with a natural understanding of, or a natural inclination towards spirituality and a deep drive and determination have led me to where I am now. Is it fateful? I don't know. Or is it just luck of the draw? And this is how things ended up. And if I hadn't managed to pull it off, I think probably now I would be dead or an addict.
You know, I don't, as someone who has had a number of big, bad things that have occurred medically and interpersonally and the like, losses as well as just, so you know what I mean if I say a fractal, right? The draw, and if you looked at a fractal, there are some places that are almost blank space, and there are other places where there's a lot going on, a lot of little pieces and angles and the little paisleys and the like. Those busy places are called chaos attractors. That's me. That's my life. It's just, if weird, like I've actually balked at writing an autobiography because I'm like, I don't know how I would market this. Like it's not a competition. It's just weird stuff happens to me. And I've learned how to sort of wait for the next weird stuff. And so often when the weird stuff is going down, many times it is at least briefly uncontrolled and often unpleasant, like especially if it's medical. People will say to me, everything happens for a reason. And I hate that. I hate that with a hate that is more than hate. Because sometimes bad things happen for no reason at all. And sometimes good things happen for no reason at all. And I feel like there's a certain degree of cosmic randomness that we all just stumble into. But I do believe that I had to go through everything I went through in order to end up sitting here talking to you on the other side of the world right now. And that sitting here with you on the other side of the world right now is pretty cool. It's pretty great. And I had to go through all that other stuff. So I don't believe in regret. And therefore, I also don't believe in fate. I think that my personality is what it is, and I think I expose myself and open myself to chaos because I don't know any different. But I may try for boring. I'm thinking about it. I'm giving it thought. Like, that might be interesting. But that until then, this right here, this is good. This is happy for me.
Maybe the chaos feels like home.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. So I don't know any different. Like, this is, my life has been chaotic. And then when the medical things started to happen, that just was like, well, yep, here we go again. Now what? And I remember one of the biggest, it was that I effectively died in childbirth in 2010. And I was still in the ICU. I had just come out of a 10-day coma, and my husband came in the room, and I recognized him. I recognized his smile, but I didn't know his name. But that was fine because I didn't know my own. So I felt like that was fair. And I remember saying to him, I don't know what just happened, but I know that we need to get into therapy to work through this together, because I don't know whether it was bad or good or needed to be or not needed to be. But the point is, this is what happened. And you are no longer married to the 22-year-old that you married. Like, me at 32 was very different. And now me at 45 is different once again. And so, yeah, I live in it. I live in the chaos, and it feels like home. But I don't, I feel there are times where I feel like the only way I could not seek it out is to stop answering my phone. And that's okay. Like, that's a part of my life that I own. And people are like, I can't believe that happened to you. Everything happens for a reason. And we go around the roller coaster again.
I'm with you, Kate, on everything happens for a reason is, for me as well, my most hated phrase, because the truth is that everything does happen for a reason. And it's almost like this is painted in this faux spiritual way of everything happens for a reason, so it's got to be good. If I walk out into the traffic and I get hit by a car, the reason that I get hit by the car is because I walked out into the traffic. And so this is where I get so frustrated. There is cause and effect. Of course, you know, these things do happen because something preceded it. But this idea that means it's fundamentally a good thing to happen is just such a false way of looking at the world, and one that I too find very frustrating.
It feels simplistic. It feels like,
very,
you know, people are using it as a way to sort of self-soothe, that as long as they can look at me and find the thing about my life that is different, then they can say that's the reason, because I don't want that thing to happen to me. And I'm like, great, great, glad I could help you sleep at night, moving on. So what does a happiness strategist do?
Teaches people who are struggling with their happiness a series of strategies to be able to shift their happiness levels and raise them up.
Are they consistent among people, or does it start with an assessment?
They're relatively consistent. If I'm looking at someone who's suffering deeply from depression, there's a number of things I can look at immediately that we can, you know, do an analysis of and see that there's probably some sort of breakdown there. And one of the first things that I'll see is that there's a breakdown in social structure and community. It's one of the first indicators that someone's in trouble, or depression is one of the first indicators that the social structure is broken down. And I think this is coming out more and more due to, you know, the pandemic and people becoming deeply isolated, feeling comfortable in that, because for a lot of us, it's been nice to have a break from the world, but now getting so entrenched and caught in their bubbles that it's harder to come out of it. So we're seeing stress, anxiety, and depression levels that are really going through the roof. I mean, the World Health Organization said pre-pandemic that by 2030, the biggest health concern worldwide would be depression. And that would be by 2030. And I think that we're well on the way to that now. And I'm seeing it across the board with people. People are really struggling. And a lot of that is because we were forced to remove ourselves from, you know, our social structure and our social communities. And that has a massive, massive effect on our happiness levels.
What do you tell someone if they balk at any given suggestion that you give them. Do you see that as a diagnostic of sorts, an indicator of sorts, or do you pull one of the other cards out of the deck and come back to that one later?
The card I pull out of my deck is this. If you've got resistance to what I'm telling you, experiment with it. Just try it. Like, give it a go and see what happens. Because that's how I found my way, was I tried a whole bunch of things and I experimented with it. So I have a course called The Happiness Baseline. It's an 8-week online course. And what we do at the beginning of The Happiness Baseline is we test people with the Penn State University Happiness Inventory, which is kind of the standard checker of where your happiness levels are at. So we test people at the beginning of 8 weeks, and we test them at the end of 8 weeks when they get to the end of their course, end of the course. And we have a 100% success rate in shifting the happiness levels of people who complete the course. So I know what I'm doing works. And so if someone has a little bit of a, oh, I've got a resistance to this, I'm like, listen, I've seen this work. So just give it a go. See what happens. Like, try it and then see how you feel. If it doesn't shift your happiness levels over this next week or so, that's fine. Not a problem. But you may find that it does. So I'm a big believer for myself, and anything I have deep resistance to is usually, you know, is usually holding something that I don't want to deal with or face. And often that can be, you know, the key. Like, I just had a client today who was just, you know, having a massive resistance to something, totally flipping out. And it was amazing because we were then able to see, oh, this is where her triggers lie, right? And to see that even her, she had a big reaction to me. And even in her reaction to me, there was the work sitting right there. And she apologized later and she said, I'm so sorry that I spoke to you that way. And I was like, I don't have any problem with it. It's great. Like, this is where the work is in your deep resistance to what was happening. And she saw it. And it was a massive, massive breakthrough moment. So I always think, if I'm scared of something, then usually that's something I will move towards because there's something in me that's blocked there. So I always gently try to encourage that. And I never say that I know, like, I never say I've got all the answers at all, but I'm a deep encourager of experiment with it. This is my suggestion, experiment, see if it works. And that's how we get results.
Is there a class or a sort of genre of thing that most people seem resistant to, or is it sort of scattershot?
It's pretty much scattershot. There's one thing that people resist, and I do talk about very carefully because of that, and that is their relationship with technology. And I think that people are so addicted to their technology that there's a fear that I'm going to come along and say, okay, let it all go. And I don't, and I wouldn't. But to have a conscious relationship with technology is incredibly difficult when we're living in a world where it's all kind of set up to make us as unconscious and as addicted as we possibly can be to devices and social media and news cycles. And so it's a really, yeah, that's the one that people get nervous on. And yet, as time's gone on, Kate, I see more and more how insipid it is, how problematic it is, how it's robbing us of so many things that actually make us happy. So I have to have a very gentle approach to looking at technology so that people don't freak out and become afraid. But again, just to gently experiment, you know, start to look at how much time do you spend on your devices? How often are you picking them up? And how do you feel when you've spent half an hour on social media? You know, what did you expect to feel as you went into that experience, and what do you feel at the end? And usually those two things are quite different. And when you offer people the opportunity to just relax their hold a little bit on their devices and on technology, they do see that they feel better quite quickly. However, we're up against a whole system that's, you know, rigged to try and keep us deeply entrenched in it.
Yeah, I had an interesting, again with that word, but I'll go with it, an interesting experience with social media myself in the sense that so I've been on permanent physical disability since 2014. I broke my back. Bad idea. Don't do that. And between 2014 and 2018, I spent a lot of time on Facebook, primarily a little bit on Twitter, but mostly on Facebook, and didn't like it, didn't enjoy it. I either ended up feeling badly about myself because other people were posting all of these happy photos, and I was like, I don't feel that way. Or I felt fake because I realized I was only sharing the happy bits and pieces of my life. And so right around 2018, when I started the podcast, I started doing social media. The vast, vast majority of my time on social media is promotion for the show. And then when I'm done, I back away. I don't watch news. I don't get involved in political debates. I don't share a ton personally on social media because I feel like, look, I already share, like I overshare on the podcast. That's fine. I don't do much in the way of filters for me, so that's okay. But I stopped on social media and I realized I enjoy it more now because it has a purpose. It has a cause and a purpose for me and I can set it down. I don't doom scroll. I don't share things that I don't want to, but I also have learned to share more vulnerability. And that's not easy. Like, I don't think it's easy for anybody to say, I'm having a really hard day today. But the number of people who respond positively to that, to be like, oh, thank God, me too. I didn't think anybody else out there was unhappy. And it's like, okay, but can we agree that that's today? That we're having a rough day today, but we're going to try tomorrow and see what happens? And that has been really interesting because it was definitely a crutch for me for a while. For several years, there was this feeling of like, this is my only connection to the outside world. And then when I developed another connection, it felt better. I don't know if it felt happier, but it felt more controlled, which perhaps is a version of happiness.
There's nothing worse than that feeling, Kate, of being out of control with things that are kind of leading you rather than you being able to lead them.
Right. And the algorithms are all specifically built in for you to get sucked in and over your head. And you're lost in the noise of Twitter or of Facebook before you even realize that you've started to wander around in it.
One of the things that I really encourage my clients to do is to put these limits on their social media. So, you know, you can set up on Facebook where you can say to yourself, I'm going to spend X amount of time every day on this app. And as soon as you reach that point, for me, it's 15 minutes. And so as soon as I reach that 15-minute point, 5 minutes beforehand, it warns me. And then it shuts the whole thing down. And I have to, maybe I'm just finishing something and I can give myself one more minute, or I can double my time, or I can ignore the limit. But I need to do it consciously. And I think that this is where it's really helpful for us, because we all know that we can get onto, you know, social media, and before we know it, you know, so much time has disappeared and we feel sick. It's almost like eating too much chocolate, you know, going and saying, I'm just going to have one piece of chocolate, and you eat the whole thing and then you feel nauseous from it. That is our relationship with social media. And then we don't feel good. And then the crazy thing is that we come back to it again, believing it's going to give us the hit that will make us feel better. So it creates this very vicious cycle with it.
I remember having an argument of sorts with a coworker 1,000 years ago at a previous job, because I said it in an offhand way, but then I realized later that I meant it, that I had never met a happy addict, that as soon as someone qualifies as having an addiction, whether it's to an activity or to a drug or whatever the case may be, as soon as the thing is stronger than they are, that they're not a happy person. And I think it's that what you're speaking to now, that feeling of control just evaporates.
Well, it means that other things are controlling your mind rather than you being able to be in control of your mind. And addictions, you know, as we all know, can be, you know, we can be addicted to our phones and social media and all sorts of things online. It doesn't have to be food or alcohol or drugs, you know. And I think that we're living in a world now where we've literally been specifically created into addicts. And there's a lot of people making a lot of money on our addictions.
There is. And so I can see, I can imagine, like, because for me, it was a case that I simply didn't have time to continue with the personal social media use on top of learning how to podcast. And so I had to set it aside because I wanted to create this podcast. And I told myself, like a game, that I play with myself on the regular, because I don't have the stamina that I used to, and I don't have the ability that I perhaps would want to carry everything through to the end. You know, there are things that I just burn out on, or like I feel, as a, for instance, I feel very strongly that when I come down, I record and edit in my basement. And when I come down to my basement and I'm going to do some work on the computer, I need to give it my whole heart and my whole mind. And if I can't do that, I'm selling my guest short. And so a part of my brain says, then don't even start. Because there are some times where I think about all of the steps that have to be taken and my brain says, no. So instead, I've learned to tell myself, I'm not going to do the whole episode. I'm going to go downstairs and turn on my computer. That's all. And if I get down there and it feels okay, then I'm going to open the program. Then I'm going to start editing. And 99% of the time, I end up staying with it, getting focused, putting out the whole episode and going. But if I tell myself in advance, that's what it's got to be, I talk myself out of it. And I think I might have done that. If someone had told me, you're going to wean yourself off social media, I would have thought in the all or nothing mindset, and I never would have started to try. I would have just clung to it. You know, you can have my phone when you pry it from my cold, dead hand kind of feeling. But instead, giving myself permission to tap out, giving myself permission to say, look, I turned on the computer. That was the goal. That's enough for today. That's not a failure if I can't do any more than that. I think that was important for me. Is your opinion that that's enough, or do you think that I tend to sell myself short on that?
I mean, I think that that's really up to you, you know? That is what are your beliefs? What are your limiting beliefs? And how far do you want to go? Everybody doesn't have to reach like an extreme limit of potential. It's more like what makes me feel good in myself? And what is it that makes you feel good?
I mean, for me, what I learned is what makes me feel good is to meet my own promises, whether they are to other people or to myself. So I'm careful with the promises I give away, and with the plans that I make with myself, I try to be clear about what I am certain I can do. And so I'm certain I can go downstairs and turn on the computer, and then we go from there.
Because it's interesting, because actually, you know, we often think that achieving goals makes us happy. But what you've highlighted is, sorry, that's my dog coughing in case you heard a strange sound. He's on my knee. It's not goals that achieving goals that makes us happy. It's achieving goals that are in alignment with our values. Sexually satisfying our values is one of the things that makes us happy. So when you talk about that, what you're saying is, I'm actually clear about what my values are. And when I'm satisfying my values, then I feel good. And that's exactly right.
And it's a true thing, is that failure feels terrible to me, especially if I'm letting someone else down. That feels terrible. So part of it is misery avoidance. But it turns out that in avoiding misery, I'm finding productivity and finding relevance and finding happiness.
Great. I love it.
And that's what I've tried with my kids, to teach them about, like, look, if you can't do the whole thing, whatever the thing is, the project, the, you know, the arts and crafts project or the school homework or whatever, if you can't do the whole thing, let's find a slice that you can handle, and then we'll figure out the next slice, but we'll do it a little at a time, because otherwise projects can become this monster in your mind that just become huge. Do you still now, and I would never ask how old you are, but some number of days past your early 20s when you first had this epiphany?
Only just.
Do you still find yourself falling back into old habits, or has happiness become a habit for you?
I mean, we all fall into old habits, and they're usually triggers, you know, where things trigger us. someone will say something and, you know, and we're triggered. So we all have that, I think, until we reach some kind of enlightenment. But I have to say that happiness truly is my habit. Like, I would say that I'm happy 85% of the time. I wake up happy. I go through my day happy. Not in a way that it's hard work, but it's just a state of mind. And the wonderful thing is that as you learn to work with your mind and you get yourself to a place of being happier, it's not that bad things don't happen. It's not that painful, hurtful things don't happen. They do, but they don't affect you in the same way. And I think that has been the most wonderful thing for me to understand, is that it's not that you're living in some kind of euphoric state. It's that the same things happen, but the way that you're handling them is completely different.
Have you had to relearn that lesson individually and laboriously through various facets of your life, or are you smarter than many and able to sort of generalize rather than falling in the same pit over again?
Look, there was no epiphany. It was truly a matter of just learning, you know, over many years and still learning to work with my mind so that when triggers happen, that I don't respond, you know, instantly as I used to. And also really understanding that, I think the one of the biggest things I understand now is that, you know, when my emotions come up, I'm not afraid of them. Good emotions, difficult emotions, they're all there to be experienced. And I'm not scared of them like I used to be. I was so afraid of them. And I think that when we take our emotions and we bundle them up and we put them in a box and we try and run away from them, you know, they really become problematic for us. And I think that for a lot of us is this fear of who we are is a really big thing. And getting to know yourself and getting to know yourself away from the screens and all of that is so powerful, because you start to see that you're much more in charge of your life than you actually ever realized you were.
One of the points that Monique brought up that it stayed with me and it has still stayed with me since we recorded, which was a couple of months ago, is the idea of chasing happiness, and that the harder you push to force it, the less likely you'll find it, because happiness is not a drug or a food or a specific activity. It's mindset. And I think that's something that a lot of us, self included, have screwed up sometimes, that we've thought, like, I'll feel better if I just fill in this blank with whatever it is. If I just accomplish this score in a game, or if I just reach out and connect with somebody that hasn't been real healthy for me in the past, but this time it'll be okay. And that's the one I'm super guilty of. And I know who I'm talking about, even though I'm not going to call them out by name right now, but they're are at least a couple of people who have broken my heart. And a part of me has felt like, you know, maybe we just need one more conversation and then I'll feel happy. And I'm working really hard on understanding that my happiness doesn't lie within their response to me. And that's hard to absorb, but I think important. Anyway, I just, this was a conversation that stayed with me. So, Monique, thank you so much for your time and your insight and for taking a different approach to things than a lot of people do. I think that's important. Thank you guys for listening. I hope you're doing okay. I hope you're safe. if there's something that I can do to help, and there's not a ton, like, I'm not rolling in money, and money isn't the answer anyway, and I don't have answers for your life because your life is complicated. All lives are complicated. And so I can't just have a conversation and tell you, here's how you feel better. But I can just have a conversation. And I'm always willing to do that. Your happiness is important, and your presence is important. You matter.